was sometimes esteemed or rejected as a foreign luxury. Liberty had peopled the mountains of Wales and the morasses of Armorica, but their populousness has been maliciously ascribed to the loose practice of polygamy, and the houses of these licentious barbarians have been supposed to contain 10 wives and perhaps 50 children. Their disposition was rash and choleric. They were bold in action and in speech, and as they were ignorant of the arts of peace, they alternately indulged their passions in foreign and domestic war. The cavalry of Armorica, the spearmen of Gwent, and the archers of Merioneth were equally formidable, but their poverty could seldom procure either shields or helmets, and the inconvenient weight would have retarded the speed and agility of their desultory operations. One of the greatest of the English monarchs was requested to satisfy the curiosity of a Greek emperor concerning the state of Britain, and Henry II could assert from his personal experience that Wales was inhabited by a race of naked warriors who encountered without fear the defensive armor of their enemies. By the revolution of Britain, the limits of science as well as of empire were contracted. The dark cloud which had been cleared by the Phoenician discoveries and finally dispelled by the arms of Caesar again settled on the shores of the Atlantic, and a Roman province was again lost among the fabulous islands of the ocean. 150 years after the reign of Honorius, the gravest historian of the times describes the wonders of a remote isle whose eastern and western parts are divided by an antique wall, the boundary of life and death, or more properly, of truth and fiction. The east is a fair country, inhabited by civilized people. The air is healthy, the waters are pure and plentiful, and the earth yields her regular and fruitful increase. In the west, beyond the wall, the air is infectious and mortal. The ground is covered with serpents, and this dreary solitude is the region of departed spirits who are transported from the opposite shores in substantial boats and by living rowers. Some families of fishermen, the subjects of the Franks, are excused from tribute in consideration of the mysterious office which is performed by these Charons of the ocean. Each in his turn is summoned at the hour of midnight to hear the voices and even the names of the ghosts. He is sensible of their weight, and he feels himself impelled by an unknown but irresistible power. After this dream of fancy, we read with astonishment that the name of this island is Britia, that it lies in the ocean, against the mouth of the Rhine, and less than 30 miles from the continent, that it is possessed by 3 nations, the Frisians, the Angles, and the Britons, and that some Angles had appeared at Constantinople in the train of the French ambassadors. From these ambassadors, Procopius might be informed of a singular, though not improbable, adventure, which announces the spirit rather than the delicacy of an English heroine. She had been betrothed to Radiger, king of the Varni, a tribe of Germans who touched the ocean and the Rhine. But the perfidious lover was tempted by motives of policy to prefer his father's widow, the sister of Theodebert, king of the Franks. The forsaken princess of the Angles, instead of bewailing, revenged her disgrace. Her warlike subjects are said to have been ignorant of the use and even of the form of a horse. But she boldly sailed from Britain to the mouth of the Rhine with a fleet of 400 ships and an army of 100,000 men. After the loss of a battle, the captive Radiger implored the mercy of his victorious bride, who generously pardoned his offense, dismissed her rival, and compelled the king of the Varni to discharge with honor and fidelity the duties of a husband. This gallant exploit appears to be the last naval enterprise of the Anglo-Saxons. The arts of navigation by which they acquired the empire of Britain and of the sea were soon neglected by the indolent barbarians, who supinely renounced all the commercial advantages of their insular situation. 7 independent kingdoms were agitated by perpetual discord, and the British world was seldom connected, either in peace or war, with the nations of the continent. I have now accomplished the laborious narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, from the fortunate age of Trajan and the Antonines to its total extinction in the West, about 5 centuries after the Christian era. At that unhappy period, the Saxons fiercely struggled with the natives for the possession of Britain. Gaul and Spain were divided between the powerful monarchies of the Franks and Visigoths and the dependent kingdoms of the Suevi and Burgundians. Africa was exposed to the cruel persecution of the Vandals and the savage insults of the Moors. Rome and Italy, as far as the banks of the Danube, were afflicted by an army of barbarian mercenaries, whose lawless tyranny was succeeded by the reign of Theodoric the Ostrogoth. All the subjects of the empire, who, by the use of the Latin language, more particularly deserved the name and privileges of Romans, were oppressed by the disgrace and calamities of foreign conquest. And the victorious nations of Germany established a new system of manners and government in the western countries of Europe. The majesty of Rome was faintly represented by the princes of Constantinople, the feeble and imaginary successors of Augustus. Yet they continued to reign over the East from the Danube to the Nile and Tigris. The Gothic and Vandal kingdoms of Italy and Africa were subverted by the arms of Justinian. And the history of the Greek emperors may still afford a long series of instructive lessons and interesting revolutions. Part 6. General Observations on the Fall of the Roman Empire in the West. The Greeks, after their country had been reduced into a province, imputed the triumphs of Rome not to the merit, but to the fortune of the Republic. The inconstant goddess who so blindly distributes and resumes her favors had now consented, such was the language of envious flattery, to resign her wings, to descend from her globe, and to fix her firm and immutable throne on the banks of the Tiber. A wiser Greek who has composed with a philosophic spirit the memorable history of his own times deprived his countrymen of this vain and delusive comfort by opening to their view the deep foundations of the greatness of Rome. The fidelity of the citizens to each other and to the state was confirmed by the habits of education and the prejudices of religion. Honor, as well as virtue, was the principle of the Republic. The ambitious citizens labored to deserve the solemn glories of a triumph, and the ardor of the Roman youth was kindled into active emulation as often as they beheld the domestic images of their ancestors. The temperate struggles of the patricians and plebeians had finally established the firm and equal balance of the constitution, which united the freedom of popular assemblies with the authority and wisdom of a senate, and the executive powers of a regal magistrate. When the consul displayed the standard of the Republic, each citizen bound himself by the obligation of an oath to draw his sword in the cause of his country till he had discharged the sacred duty by military service of 10 years. This wise institution continually poured into the field the rising generations of freemen and soldiers, and their numbers were reinforced by the warlike and populous states of Italy, who, after a brave resistance, had yielded to the valor and embraced the alliance of the Romans. The sage historian, who excited the virtue of the younger Scipio and beheld the ruin of Carthage, has accurately described their military system, their levies, arms, exercises, subordination, marches, encampments, and the invincible legion, superior in active strength to the Macedonian phalanx of Philip and Alexander. From these institutions of peace and war, Polybius has deduced the spirit and success of a people incapable of fear and impatient of repose. The ambitious design of conquest, which might have been defeated by the seasonable conspiracy of mankind, was attempted and achieved, and the perpetual violation of justice was maintained by the political virtues of prudence and courage. The arms of the Republic, sometimes vanquished in battle, always victorious in war, advanced with rapid steps to the Euphrates, the Danube, the Rhine, and the ocean, and the images of gold or silver or brass that might serve to represent the nations and their kings were successively broken by the iron monarchy of Rome. The rise of a city which swelled into an empire may deserve as a singular prodigy the reflection of a philosophic mind, but the decline of Rome was the natural and inevitable effect of immoderate greatness. Prosperity ripened the principle of decay. The causes of destruction multiplied with the extent of conquest, and as soon as time or accident had removed the artificial supports, the stupendous fabric yielded to the pressure of its own weight. The story of its ruin is simple and obvious, and instead of inquiring why the Roman Empire was destroyed, we should rather be surprised that it had subsisted so long. The victorious legions who in distant wars acquired the vices of strangers and mercenaries first oppressed the freedom of the Republic and afterwards violated the majesty of the purple. The emperors, anxious for their personal safety and the public peace, were reduced to the base expedient of corrupting the discipline which rendered them alike formidable to their sovereign and to the enemy. The vigor of the military government was relaxed and finally dissolved by the partial institutions of Constantine, and the Roman world was overwhelmed by a deluge of barbarians. The decay of Rome has been frequently ascribed to the translation of the seat of empire, but this history has already shown that the powers of government were divided rather than removed. The throne of Constantinople was erected in the east, while the West was still possessed by a series of emperors who held their residence in Italy and claimed their equal inheritance of the legions and provinces. This dangerous novelty impaired the strength and fomented the vices of a double reign. The instruments of an oppressive and arbitrary system were multiplied, and a vain emulation of luxury, not of merit, was introduced and supported between the degenerate successors of Theodosius. Extreme distress, which unites the virtue of a free people, embitters the factions of a declining monarchy. The hostile favorites of Arcadius and Honorius betrayed the Republic to its common enemies, and the Byzantine court beheld with indifference, perhaps with pleasure, the disgrace of Rome, the misfortunes of Italy, and the loss of the West. Under the succeeding reigns, the alliance of the two empires was restored, but the aid of the Oriental Romans was tardy, doubtful, and ineffectual, and the national schism of the Greeks and Latins was enlarged by the perpetual difference of language and manners, of interests, and even of religion. Yet the salutary event approved in some measure the judgment of Constantine. During a long period of decay, his impregnable city repelled the victorious armies of barbarians, protected the wealth of Asia, and commanded both in peace and war the important straits which connect the Black Sea and Mediterranean seas. The foundation of Constantinople more essentially contributed to the preservation of the East than to the ruin of the West. As the happiness of a future life is the great object of religion, we may hear, without surprise or scandal, that the introduction, or at least the abuse, of Christianity had some influence on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The clergy successfully preached the doctrines of patience and pusillanimity. The active virtues of society were discouraged, and the last remains of military spirit were buried in the cloister. A large portion of public and private wealth was consecrated to the specious demands of charity and devotion, and the soldiers' pay was lavished on the useless multitudes of both sexes who could only plead the merits of abstinence and chastity. Faith, zeal, curiosity, and the more earthly passions of malice and ambition kindled the flame of theological discord. The church and even the state were distracted by religious factions whose conflicts were sometimes bloody and always implacable. The attention of the emperors was diverted from camps to synods. The Roman world was oppressed by a new species of tyranny, and the persecuted sects became the secret enemies of their country. Yet party spirit, however pernicious or absurd, is a principle of union as well as of dissension. The bishops, from 1800 pulpits, inculcated the duty of passive obedience to a lawful and orthodox sovereign. Their frequent assemblies and perpetual correspondence maintained the communion of distant churches, and the malevolent temper of the gospel was strengthened, though confined, by the spiritual alliance of the Catholics. The sacred indolence of the monks was devoutly embraced by servile and effeminate age. But if superstition had not afforded a decent retreat, the same vices would have tempted the unworthy Romans to desert, from baser motives, the standard of the Republic. Religious precepts are easily obeyed, which indulge and sanctify the natural inclinations of their votaries. But the pure and genuine influence of Christianity may be traced in its beneficial, though imperfect, effects on the barbarian proselytes of the North. If the decline of the Roman Empire was hastened by the conversion of Constantine, his victorious religion broke the violence of the fall and mollified the ferocious temper of the conquerors. This awful revolution may be usefully applied to the instruction of the present age. It is the duty of a patriot to prefer and promote the exclusive interest and glory of his native country, but a philosopher may be permitted to enlarge his views and to consider Europe as one great republic whose various inhabitants have obtained almost the same level of politeness and cultivation. The balance of power will continue to fluctuate, and the prosperity of our own or the neighboring kingdoms may be alternately exalted or depressed. But these partial events cannot essentially injure our general state of happiness, the system of arts and laws and manners which so advantageously distinguish above the rest of mankind the Europeans and their colonies. The savage nations of the globe are the common enemies of civilized society, and we may inquire with anxious curiosity whether Europe is still threatened with a repetition of those calamities which formerly oppressed the arms and institutions of Rome. Perhaps the same reflections will illustrate the fall of that mighty empire and explain the probable causes of our actual security. 1. The Romans were ignorant of the extent of their danger and the number of their enemies. Beyond the Rhine and Danube, the northern countries of Europe and Asia were filled with innumerable tribes of hunters and shepherds, poor, voracious, and turbulent, bold in arms and impatient to ravish the fruits of industry. The barbarian world was agitated by the rapid impulse of war, and the peace of Gaul or Italy was shaken by the distant revolutions of China. The Huns, who fled before a victorious enemy, directed their march towards the west, and the torrent was swelled by the gradual accession of captives and allies. The flying tribes who yielded to the Huns assumed in their turn the spirit of conquest. The endless column of barbarians pressed on the Roman Empire with accumulated weight, and if the foremost were destroyed, the vacant space was instantly replenished by new assailants. Such formidable emigrations can no longer issue from the north, and the long repose which has been imputed to the decrease of population is the happy consequence of the progress of arts and agriculture. Instead of some rude villages thinly scattered among its woods and morasses, Germany now produces a list of 2,300 walled towns. The Christian kingdoms of Denmark, Sweden, and Poland have been successively established, and the Hansa merchants with the Teutonic Knights have extended their colonies along the coast of the Baltic as far as the Gulf of Finland. From the Gulf of Finland to the Eastern Ocean, Russia now assumes the form of a powerful and civilized empire. The plow, the loom, and the forge are introduced on the banks of the Volga, the Obi, and the Lena, and the fiercest of the Tatar hordes have been taught to tremble and obey. The reign of independent barbarism is now contracted to a narrow span, and the remnant of Kalmucks or Uzbeks, whose forces may be almost numbered, cannot seriously excite the apprehensions of the great Republic of Europe. Yet this apparent security should not tempt us to forget that new enemies and unknown dangers may possibly arise from some obscure people scarcely visible in the map of the world. the Arabs or Saracens who spread their conquests from India to Spain, had languished in poverty and contempt till Mohammed breathed into those savage bodies the soul of enthusiasm. 2. The Empire of Rome was firmly established by the singular and perfect coalition of its members. The subject nations, resigning the hope and even the wish of independence, embraced the character of Roman citizens, and the provinces of the West were reluctantly torn by the barbarians from the bosom of their mother country. But this union was purchased by the loss of national freedom and military spirit, and the servile provinces, destitute of life and motion, expected their safety from the mercenary troops and governors who were directed by the orders of a distant court. The happiness of 100 millions depended on the personal merit of 1 or 2 men, perhaps children, whose minds were corrupted by education, luxury, and despotic power. The deepest wounds were inflicted on the empire during the minorities of the sons and grandsons of Theodosius. And after those incapable princes seemed to attain the age of manhood, they abandoned the church to the bishops, the state to the eunuchs, and the provinces to the barbarians. Europe is now divided into 12 powerful, though unequal, kingdoms, 3 respectable commonwealths, and a variety of smaller, though independent, states. The chances of royal and ministerial talents are multiplied at least with the number of its rulers, and a Julian or Semiramis may reign in the north, while Arcadius and Honorius again slumber on the thrones of the south. The abuses of tyranny are restrained by the mutual influence of fear and shame. Republics have acquired order and stability. Monarchies have imbibed the principles of freedom, or at least of moderation, and some sense of honor and justice is introduced into the most defective constitutions by the general manners of the times. In peace, the progress of knowledge and industry is accelerated by the emulation of so many active rivals. In war, the European forces are exercised by temperate and undecisive contests. If a savage conqueror should issue from the deserts of Tartary, he must repeatedly vanquish the robust peasants of Russia, the numerous armies of Germany, the gallant nobles of France, and the intrepid freemen of Britain, who, perhaps, might confederate for their common defense. Should the victorious barbarians carry slavery and desolation as far as the Atlantic Ocean, 10,000 vessels would transport beyond their pursuit the remains of civilized society, and Europe would revive and flourish in the American world, which is already filled with her colonies and institutions. 3. Cold, poverty, and a life of danger and fatigue fortify the strength and courage of barbarians. In every age they have oppressed the polite and peaceful nations of China, India, and Persia, who neglected and still neglect to counterbalance these natural powers by the resources of military art. The warlike states of antiquity, Greece, Macedonia, and Rome, educated a race of soldiers, exercised their bodies, disciplined their courage, multiplied their forces by regular evolutions, and converted the iron, which they possessed, into strong and serviceable weapons. But this superiority insensibly declined with their laws and manners, and the feeble policy of Constantine and his successors, armed and instructed for the ruin of the empire, the rude valor of the barbarian mercenaries. The military art has been changed by the invention of gunpowder, which enables man to command the 2 most powerful agents of nature, air and fire. Mathematics, chemistry, mechanics, architecture have been applied to the service of war, and the adverse parties oppose to each other the most elaborate modes of attack and of defense. Historians may indignantly observe that the preparations of a siege would found and maintain a flourishing colony, yet we cannot be displeased that the subversion of a city should be a work of cost and difficulty, or that an industrious people should be protected by those arts which survive and supply the decay of military virtue. Cannon and fortifications now form an impregnable barrier against the Tartar horse. And Europe is secure from any future eruption of barbarians, since before they can conquer, they must cease to be barbarous. Their gradual advances in the science of war would always be accompanied, as we may learn from the example of Russia, with a proportionable improvement in the arts of peace and civil policy. And they themselves must deserve a place among the polished nations whom they subdue. Should these speculations be found doubtful or fallacious, there still remains a more humble source of comfort and hope. The discoveries of ancient and modern navigators and the domestic history or tradition of the most enlightened nations represent the human savage, naked both in body and mind, and destitute of laws, of arts, of ideas, and almost of language. From this abject condition, perhaps the primitive and universal state of man, he has gradually arisen to command the animals, to fertilize the earth, to traverse the ocean, and to measure the heavens. His progress in the improvement and exercise of his mental and corporeal faculties has been irregular and various, infinitely slow in the beginning, and increasing by degrees with redoubled velocity. Ages of laborious ascent have been followed by a moment of rapid downfall, and the several climates of the globe have felt the vicissitudes of light and darkness. Yet the experience of 4,000 years should enlarge our hopes and diminish our apprehensions. We cannot determine to what height the human species may aspire in their advances towards perfection, but it may safely be presumed that no people, unless the face of nature is changed, will relapse into their original barbarism. The improvements of society may be viewed under a threefold aspect. One, the poet or philosopher illustrates his age and country by the efforts of a single mind. But those superior powers of reason or fancy are rare and spontaneous productions, and the genius of Homer or Cicero or Newton would excite less admiration if they could be created by the will of a prince or the lessons of a preceptor. Two, the benefits of law and policy, of trade and manufactures, of arts and sciences, are more solid and permanent, and many individuals may be qualified by education and discipline to promote in their respective stations the interest of the community. But this general order is the effect of skill and labor, and the complex machinery may be decayed by time or injured by violence. 3. Fortunately for mankind, the more useful, or at least more necessary, arts can be performed without superior talents or national subordination, without the powers of one or the union of many. Each village, each family, each individual must always possess both ability and inclination to perpetuate the use of fire and of metals, the propagation and service of domestic animals, the methods of hunting and fishing, the rudiments of navigation, the imperfect cultivation of corn or other nutritive grain, and the simple practice of the mechanic trades. Private genius and public industry may be extirpated, but these hardy plants survive the tempest and strike an everlasting root into the most unfavorable soil. The splendid days of Augustus and Trajan were eclipsed by a cloud of ignorance, and the barbarians subverted the laws and palaces of Rome. But the scythe, the invention or emblem of Saturn, still continue annually to mow the harvests of Italy. Then the human feasts of the Laestrigons have never been renewed on the coast of Campania. Since the first discovery of the arts, war, commerce, and religious zeal have diffused among the savages of the old and new world these inestimable gifts. They have been successively propagated. They can never be lost. We may therefore acquiesce in the pleasing conclusion that every age of the world has increased and still increases the real wealth, the happiness, the knowledge, and perhaps the virtue of the human race. Chapter 39. Zeno and Anastasius, emperors of the East. Birth, education, and first exploits of Theodoric the Ostrogoth. His invasion and conquest of Italy. The Gothic Kingdom of Italy. State of the West. Military and civil government. The Senator Boethius. Last Acts and Death of Theodoric. Part 1. After the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, an interval of 50 years, till the memorable reign of Justinian, is faintly marked by the obscure names and imperfect annals of Zeno, Anastasius, and Justin, who successively ascended to the throne of Constantinople. During the same period, Italy revived and flourished under the government of a Gothic king, who might have deserved a statue among the best and bravest of the ancient Romans. Theodoric the Ostrogoth, the 14th in lineal descent of the royal line of the Amali, was born in the neighborhood of Vienna 2 years after the death of Attila. A recent victory had restored the independence of the Ostrogoths, and the three brothers, Valamir, Theodemir, and Widemir, who ruled that warlike nation with united councils, had separately pitched their habitations in the fertile, though desolate, province of Pannonia. The Huns still threatened their revolted subjects, but their hasty attack was repelled by the single forces of Valamir, and the news of his victory reached the distant camp of his brother in the same auspicious moment that the favorite concubine of Theodemir was delivered of a son and heir. In the 8th year of his age, Theodoric was reluctantly yielded by his father to the public interest, as the pledge of an alliance which Leo, Emperor of the East, had consented to purchase by an annual subsidy of 300 pounds of gold. The royal hostage was educated at Constantinople with care and tenderness. His body was formed to all the exercises of war. His mind was expanded by the habits of liberal conversation. He frequented the school of the most skillful masters, but he disdained or neglected the arts of Greece, and so ignorant did he always remain of the first elements of science that a rude mark was contrived to represent the signature of the illiterate king of Italy. As soon as he had attained the age of 18, he was restored to the wishes of the Ostrogoths, whom the emperor aspired to gain by liberality and confidence. Valamir had fallen in battle. The youngest of the brothers, Widemir, had led away into Italy and Gaul an army of barbarians, and the whole nation acknowledged for their king the father of Theodoric. His ferocious subjects admired the strength and stature of their young prince, and he soon convinced them that he had not degenerated from the valor of his ancestors. At the head of 6,000 volunteers, he secretly left the camp in quest of adventures, descended the Danube as far as Singidunum, or Belgrade, and soon returned to his father with the spoils of a Sarmatian king whom he had vanquished and slain. Such triumphs, however, were productive only of fame, and the invincible Ostrogoths were reduced to extreme distress by the want of clothing and food. They unanimously resolved to desert their Pannonian encampments and boldly to advance into the warm and wealthy neighborhood of the Byzantine court, which already maintained in pride and luxury so many bands of confederate Goths. After proving by some acts of hostility that they could be dangerous or at least troublesome enemies, the Ostrogoths sold at a high price their reconciliation and fidelity, accepted a donative of lands and money, and were entrusted with the defense of the Lower Danube under the command of Theodoric, who succeeded after his father's death to the hereditary throne of the Amale. A hero descended from a race of kings must have despised the base Isaurian, who was invested with the Roman purple without any endowment of mind or body, without any advantages of royal birth or superior qualifications. After the failure of the Theodosian life, the choice of Pulcheria and of the Senate might be justified in some measure by the characters of Martin and Leo, but the latter of these princes confirmed and dishonored his reign by the perfidious murder of Aspar and his sons, who too rigorously exacted the debt of gratitude and obedience. The inheritance of Leo and of the East was peaceably devolved on his infant grandson, the son of his daughter Ariadne, and her Isaurian husband, the fortunate Truscalicius, exchanged that barbarous sound for the Grecian appellation of Zeno. After the decease of the elder Leo, he approached with unnatural respect the throne of his son, humbly received as a gift the second rank in the empire, and soon excited the public suspicion on the sudden and premature death of his young colleague, whose life could no longer promote the success of his ambition. But the palace of Constantinople was ruled by female influence and agitated by female passions, and Verina, the widow of Leo, claiming his empire as her own, pronounced a sentence of deposition against the worthless and ungrateful servant on whom she alone had bestowed the scepter of the East. As soon as she sounded a revolt in the ears of Zeno, he fled with precipitation into the mountains of Isauria, and her brother Basiliscus, already infamous by his African expedition, was unanimously proclaimed by the servile Senate. But the reign of the usurper was short and turbulent. Basiliscus presumed to assassinate the lover of his sister. He dared to offend the lover of his wife, the vain and insolent Hermatius, who in the midst of Asiatic luxury affected the dress, the demeanor, and the surname of Achilles. By the conspiracy of the malcontents, Zeno was recalled from exile. The armies, the capital, the person of Basiliscus were betrayed, and his whole family was condemned to the long agony of cold and hunger by the inhuman conqueror who wanted courage to encounter or to forgive his enemies. The haughty spirit of Verina was still incapable of submission or repose. She provoked the enmity of a favorite general, embraced his cause as soon as he was disgraced, created a new emperor in Syria and Egypt, raised an army of 70,000 men, and persisted to the last moment of her life in a fruitless rebellion which, according to the fashion of the age, had been predicted by Christian hermits and pagan magicians. While the East was afflicted by the passions of Verina, her daughter Ariadne was distinguished by the female virtues of mildness and fidelity. She followed her husband in his exile, and after his restoration, she implored his clemency in favor of her mother. On the decease of Zeno, Ariadne, the daughter, the mother, and the widow of an emperor, gave her hand and the imperial title to Anastasius, an aged domestic of the palace, who survived his elevation above 27 years, and whose character is attested by the acclamation of the people, "Reign as you have lived." Whatever fear of affection could bestow was profusely lavished by Zeno on the king of the Ostrogoths. The rank of patrician and consul, the command of the Palatine troops, an equestrian statue, a treasure in gold and silver of many thousand pounds, the name of son, and the promise of a rich and honorable wife. As long as Theodoric condescended to serve, he supported with courage and fidelity the cause of his benefactor. His rapid march contributed to the restoration of Zeno, and in the second revolt, the Volhemirs, as they were called, pursued and pressed the Asiatic rebels till they left an easy victory to the imperial troops. But the faithful servant was suddenly converted into a formidable enemy, who spread the flames of war from Constantinople to the Adriatic. Many flourishing cities were reduced to ashes, and the agriculture of Thrace was almost extirpated by the wanton cruelty of the Goths, who deprived their captive peasants of the right hand that guided the plough. On such occasions, Theodoric sustained the loud and specious reproach of disloyalty, of ingratitude, and of insatiate avarice, which could be only excused by the hard necessity of his situation. He reigned not as the monarch, but as the minister of a ferocious people, whose spirit was unbroken by slavery and impatient of real or imaginary insults. Their poverty was incurable, since the most liberal donatives were soon dissipated in wasteful luxury, and the most fertile estates became barren in their hands. They despised, but they envied, the laborious provincials, and when their subsistence had failed, the Ostrogoths embraced the familiar resources of war and rapine. It had been the wish of Theodoric, such at least was his declaration, to lead a peaceful, obscure, obedient life on the confines of Scythia, till the Byzantine court, by splendid and fallacious promises, seduced him to attack a confederate tribe of Goths who had been engaged in the party of Basiliscus. He marched from his station in Mysia on the solemn assurance that before he reached Adrianople, he should meet a plentiful convoy of provisions and a reinforcement of 8,000 horse and 30,000 foot, while the legions of Asia were encamped at Heraclea to second his operations. These measures were disappointed by mutual jealousy. As he advanced into Thrace, the son of Theodemir found an inhospitable solitude, and his Gothic followers, with a heavy train of horses, of mules, and of wagons, were betrayed by their guides among the rocks and precipices of Mount Sondis, where he was assaulted by the arms and invectives of Theodoric, the son of Triarius. From a neighboring height, his artful rival harangued the camp of the Valamirs, and branded their leader with the opprobrious names of child, of madman, of perjured traitor, the enemy of his blood and nation. "Are you ignorant," exclaimed the son of Triarius, "that it is the constant policy of the Romans to destroy the Goths by each other's swords? Are you insensible that the victor in this unnatural contest will be exposed, and justly exposed, to their implacable revenge? Where are those warriors, my kinsmen and thy own, whose widows now lament that their lives were sacrificed to thy rash ambition? Where is the wealth which thy soldiers possessed when they were first allured from their native homes to enlist under thy standard? Each of them was then master of 3 or 4 horses. They now follow thee on foot, like slaves, through the deserts of Thrace. Those men who were tempted by the hope of measuring gold with a bushel, those brave men who are as free and as noble as thyself." A language so well suited to the temper of the Goths excited clamor and discontent. Then the son of Theodemir, apprehensive of being left alone, was compelled to embrace his brethren and to imitate the example of Roman perfidy. In every state of his fortune, the prudence and firmness of Theodoric were equally conspicuous, whether he threatened Constantinople at the head of the confederate Goths, or retreated with a faithful band to the mountains and sea coast of Epirus. At length, the accidental death of the son of Triarius destroyed the balance which the Romans had been so anxious to preserve. The whole nation acknowledged the supremacy of the Amali, and the Byzantine court subscribed an ignominious and oppressive treaty. The Senate had already declared that it was necessary to choose a party among the Goths, since the public was unequal to the support of their united forces. A subsidy of 2,000 pounds of gold, with the ample pay of 13,000 men, were required for the least considerable of their armies. Then the Isaurians, who guarded not the empire but the emperor, enjoyed, besides the privilege of rapine, an annual pension of 5,000 pounds. The sagacious mind of Theodoric soon perceived that he was odious to the Romans, and suspected by the barbarians. He understood the popular murmur that his subjects were exposed in their frozen huts to intolerable hardships while their king was dissolved in the luxury of Greece, and he prevented the painful alternative of encountering the Goths as the champion, or of leading them to the field as the enemy of Zeno. Embracing an enterprise worthy of his courage and ambition, Theodoric addressed the emperor in the following words: "Although your servant is maintained in affluence by your liberality, graciously listen to the wishes of my heart. Italy, the inheritance of your predecessors, and Rome itself, the head and mistress of the world, now fluctuate under the violence and oppression of Odoaker, the mercenary. Direct me with my national troops to march against the tyrant. If I fall, you will be relieved from an expensive and troublesome friend. If, with the divine permission, I succeed, I shall govern in your name and to your glory the Roman Senate and the part of the Republic delivered from slavery by my victorious arms. The proposal of Theodoric was accepted, and perhaps had been suggested by the Byzantine court. But the forms of the commission or grant appear to have been expressed with a prudent ambiguity, which might be explained by the event, and it was left doubtful whether the conqueror of Italy should reign as the lieutenant, the vassal, or the ally of the Emperor of the East. The reputation both of the leader and of the war diffused a universal ardour. The Volumnians were multiplied by the Gothic swarms already engaged in the service or seated in the provinces of the empire, and each bold barbarian who had heard of the wealth and beauty of Italy was impatient to seek, through the most perilous adventures, the possession of such enchanting objects. The march of Theodoric must be considered as the emigration of an entire people. The wives and children of the Goths, their aged parents, and most precious effects were carefully transported, and some idea may be formed of the heavy baggage that now followed the camp by the loss of 2,000 wagons, which had been sustained in a single action in the War of Epirus. For their subsistence, the Goths depended on the magazines of corn which was ground in portable mills by the hands of their women, on the milk and flesh of their flocks and herds, on the casual produce of the chase, and upon the contributions which they might impose on all who should presume to dispute the passage or to refuse their friendly assistance. Notwithstanding these precautions, they were exposed to the danger and almost to the distress of famine in a march of 700 miles, which had been undertaken in the depth of a rigorous winter. Since the fall of the Roman power, Dacia and Pannonia no longer exhibited the rich prospect of populous cities, well-cultivated fields, and convenient highways. The reign of barbarism and desolation was restored, and the tribes of Bulgarians, Gepidi, and Sarmatians, who had occupied the vacant province, were prompted by their native fierceness or the solicitations of Odoaker to resist the progress of his enemy. In many obscure, though bloody, battles, Theodoric fought and vanquished, till at length, surmounting every obstacle by skilful conduct and persevering courage, he descended from the Julian Alps and displayed his invincible banners on the confines of Italy. Odoaker, a rival not unworthy of his arms, had already occupied the advantageous and well-known post of the river Sontius, near the ruins of Aquileia, at the head of a powerful host, whose independent kings or leaders disdained the duties of subordination and the prudence of delays. No sooner had Theodoric gained a short repose and refreshment to his wearied cavalry than he boldly attacked the fortifications of the enemy. The Ostrogoths showed more ardour to acquire than the mercenaries to defend the lands of Italy, and the reward of the first victory was the possession of the Venetian province as far as the walls of Verona. In the neighbourhood of that city, on the steep banks of the rapid Adige, he was opposed by a new army, reinforced in its numbers and not impaired in its courage. The contest was more obstinate, but the event was still more decisive. Odoaker fled to Ravenna, Theodoric advanced to Milan, and the vanquished troops saluted their conqueror with loud acclamations of respect and fidelity. But their want, either of constancy or of faith, soon exposed him to the most imminent danger. His vanguard, with several Gothic counts which had been rashly entrusted to a deserter, was betrayed and destroyed near Faenza by his double treachery. Odoaker again appeared master of the field, and the invader, strongly entrenched in his camp of Pavia, was reduced to solicit the aid of a kindred nation, the Visigoths of Gaul. In the course of this history, the most voracious appetite for war will be abundantly satiated. nor can I much lament that our dark and imperfect materials do not afford a more ample narrative of the distress of Italy and of the fierce conflict which was finally decided by the abilities, experience, and valor of the Gothic king. Immediately before the Battle of Verona, he visited the tent of his mother and sister, and requested that on a day, the most illustrious festival of his life, they would adorn him with the rich garments which they had worked with their own hands. "Our glory," said he, "is mutual and inseparable. You are known to the world as the mother of Theodoric, and it becomes me to prove that I am the genuine offspring of those heroes from whom I claim my descent." The wife or concubine of Theodemir was inspired with the spirit of the German matrons, who esteemed their son's honor far above their safety. And it is reported that in a desperate action, when Theodoric himself was hurried along by the torrent of a flying crowd, she boldly met them at the entrance of the camp, and by her generous reproaches drove them back on the swords of the enemy. From the Alps to the extremity of Calabria, Theodoric reigned by the right of conquest. The Vandal ambassadors surrendered the island of Sicily as a lawful appendage of his kingdom, and he was accepted as the deliverer of Rome by the Senate and people, who had shut their gates against the flying usurper. Ravenna alone, secure in the fortifications of art and nature, still sustained a siege of almost 3 years. And the daring sallies of Odoacer carried slaughter and dismay into the Gothic camp. At length, destitute of provisions and hopeless of relief, that unfortunate monarch yielded to the groans of his subjects and the clamors of his soldiers. A treaty of peace was negotiated by the Bishop of Ravenna. The Ostrogoths were admitted into the city, and the hostile kings consented under the sanction of an oath to rule with equal and undivided authority the provinces of Italy. The event of such an agreement may be easily foreseen. After some days had been devoted to the semblance of joy and friendship, Odoacer, in the midst of a solemn banquet, was stabbed by the hand, or at least by the command, of his rival. Secret and effectual orders had been previously dispatched. The faithless and rapacious mercenaries, at the same moment and without resistance, were universally massacred, and the royalty of Theodoric was proclaimed by the Goths with the tardy, reluctant, ambiguous consent of the Emperor of the East. The design of a conspiracy was imputed, according to the usual forms, to the prostrate tyrant. But his innocence and the guilt of his conqueror are sufficiently proved by the advantageous treaty which force would not sincerely have granted, nor weakness have rashly infringed. The jealousy of power and the mischiefs of discord may suggest a more decent apology, and a sentence less rigorous may be pronounced against a crime which was necessary to introduce into Italy a generation of public felicity. The living author of this felicity was audaciously praised in his own presence by sacred and profane orators, but history, in his time she was mute and inglorious, has not left any just representation of the events which displayed, or of the defects which clouded, the virtues of Theodoric. One record of his fame, the volume of public epistles composed by Cassiodorus in the royal name, is still extant, and has obtained more implicit credit than it seems to deserve. They exhibit the forms rather than the substance of his government, and we should vainly search for the pure and spontaneous sentiments of the barbarian amidst the declamation and learning of a sophist, the wishes of a Roman senator, the precedence of office, and the vague professions which, in every court and on every occasion, compose the language of discreet ministers. The reputation of Theodoric may repose with more confidence on the visible peace and prosperity of a reign of 33 years, the unanimous esteem of his own times, and the memory of his wisdom and courage, his justice and humanity, which was deeply impressed on the minds of the Goths and Italians. The partition of the lands of Italy, of which Theodoric assigned the third part to his soldiers, is honourably arraigned as the sole injustice of his life. And even this act may be fairly justified by the example of Odoacer, the rights of conquest, the true interest of the Italians, and the sacred duty of subsisting a whole people who, on the faith of his promises, had transported themselves into a distant land. Under the reign of Theodoric and in the happy climate of Italy, the Goths soon multiplied to a formidable host of 200,000 men, and the whole amount of their families may be computed by the ordinary addition of women and children. Their invasion of property, a part of which must have been already vacant, was disguised by the generous but improper name of hospitality. These unwelcome guests were irregularly dispersed over the face of Italy, and the lot of each barbarian was adequate to his birth and office, the number of his followers, and the rustic wealth which he possessed in slaves and cattle. The distinction of noble and plebeian were acknowledged, but the lands of every freeman were exempt from taxes, and he enjoyed the inestimable privilege of being subject only to the laws of his country. Fashion and even convenience soon persuaded the conquerors to assume the more elegant dress of the natives, but they still persisted in the use of their mother tongue, and their contempt for the Latin schools was applauded by Theodoric himself, who gratified their prejudices, or his own, by declaring that the child who had trembled at a rod would never dare to look upon a sword. Distress might sometimes provoke the indigent Roman to assume the ferocious manners which were insensibly relinquished by the rich and luxurious barbarian. But these mutual conversions were not encouraged by the policy of a monarch who perpetuated the separation of the Italians and Goths, reserving the former for the arts of peace and the latter for the service of war. To accomplish this design, he studied to protect his industrious subjects and to moderate the violence without enervating the valour of his soldiers, who were maintained for the public defence. They held their lands and benefices as a military stipend. At the sound of the trumpet, they were prepared to march under the conduct of their provincial officers. Then the whole extent of Italy was distributed into the several quarters of a well-regulated camp. The service of the palace and of the frontiers was performed by choice or by rotation, and each extraordinary fatigue was recompensed by an increase of pay and occasional donatives. Theodoric had convinced his brave companions that empire must be acquired and defended by the same arts. After his example, they strove to excel in the use not only of the lance and sword, the instruments of their victories, but of the missile weapons which they were too much inclined to neglect, and the lively image of war was displayed in the daily exercise and annual reviews of the Gothic cavalry. A firm, though gentle discipline imposed the habits of modesty, obedience, and temperance, and the Goths were instructed to spare the people, to reverence the laws, to understand the duties of civil society, and to disclaim the barbarous license of judicial combat and private revenge. Part 2. Among the barbarians of the West, the victory of Theodoric had spread a general alarm. But as soon as it appeared that he was satisfied with conquest and desirous of peace, terror was changed into respect, and they submitted to a powerful mediation which was uniformly employed for the best purposes of reconciling their quarrels and civilizing their manners. The ambassadors, who resorted to Ravenna from the most distant countries of Europe, admired his wisdom, magnificence, and courtesy. And if he sometimes accepted either slaves or arms, white horses or strange animals, the gift of a sundial, a water clock, or a musician, admonished even the princes of Gaul of the superior art and industry of his Italian subjects. His domestic alliances, a wife, two daughters, a sister, and a niece, united the family of Theodoric with the kings of the Franks, the Burgundians, the Visigoths, the Vandals, and the Thuringians, and contributed to maintain the harmony, or at least the balance, of the great Republic of the West. It is difficult in the dark forests of Germany and Poland to pursue the emigrations of the Heruli, a fierce people who disdain the use of armor and who condemn their widows and aged parents not to survive the loss of their husbands or the decay of their strength. The king of these savage warriors solicited the friendship of Theodoric and was elevated to the rank of his son, according to the barbaric rites of a military adoption. From the shores of the Baltic, the Estians or Livonians laid their offerings of native amber at the feet of a prince whose fame had excited them to undertake an unknown and dangerous journey of 1,500 miles. With the country from whence the Gothic nation derived their origin, he maintained a frequent and friendly correspondence. The Italians were clothed in the rich sables of Sweden, and one of its sovereigns, after a voluntary or reluctant abdication, found a hospitable retreat in the palace of Ravenna. He had reigned over one of the 13 populous tribes who cultivated a small portion of the great island or peninsula of Scandinavia, to which the vague appellation of Thule has been sometimes applied. That northern region was peopled or had been explored as high as the 68th degree of latitude, where the natives of the polar circle enjoy and lose the presence of the sun at each summer and winter solstice during an equal period of 40 days. The long night of his absence or death was the mournful season of distress and anxiety, till the messengers who had been sent to the mountain tops descried the first rays of returning light, and proclaimed to the plain below the festival of his resurrection. The life of Theodoric represents the rare and meritorious example of a barbarian who sheathed his sword in the pride of victory and the vigor of his age. A reign of 33 years was consecrated to the duties of civil government, and the hostilities in which he was sometimes involved were speedily terminated by the conduct of his lieutenants, the discipline of his troops, the arms of his allies, and even by the terror of his name. He reduced under a strong and regular government the unprofitable countries of Rhaetia, Noricum, Dalmatia and Pannonia, from the source of the Danube and the territory of the Bavarians to the petty kingdom erected by the Gepidi on the ruins of Sirmium. His prudence could not safely entrust the bulwark of Italy to such feeble and turbulent neighbors, and his justice might claim the lands which they oppressed either as a part of his kingdom or as the inheritance of his father. The greatness of a servant, who was named Perfidius because he was successful, awakened the jealousy of the Emperor Anastasius, and a war was kindled on the Dacian frontier by the protection which the Gothic king, in the vicissitude of human affairs, had granted to one of the descendants of Attila. Sabinian, a general illustrious by his own and father's merit, advanced at the head of 10,000 Romans, and the provisions and arms which filled a long train of wagons were distributed to the fiercest of the Bulgarian tribes. But in the fields of Margus, the eastern powers were defeated by the inferior forces of the Goths and Huns. The flower, and even the hope, of the Roman armies was irretrievably destroyed. And such was the temperance with which Theodoric had inspired his victorious troops that, as their leader had not given the signal of pillage, the rich spoils of the enemy lay untouched at their feet. Exasperated by this disgrace, the Byzantine court dispatched 200 ships and 8,000 men to plunder the seacoast of Calabria and Apulia. They assaulted the ancient city of Tarentum, interrupted the trade and agriculture of a happy country, and sailed back to the Hellespont, proud of their piratical victory over a people whom they still presumed to consider as their Roman brethren. Their retreat was possibly hastened by the activity of Theodoric. Italy was covered by a fleet of 1,000 light vessels, which he constructed with incredible dispatch, and his firm moderation was soon rewarded by solid and honorable peace. He maintained with a powerful hand the balance of the West, till it was at length overthrown by the ambition of Clovis. And although unable to assist his rash and unfortunate kinsman, the king of the Visigoths, he saved the remains of his family and people, and checked the Franks in the midst of their victorious career. I am not desirous to prolong or repeat this narrative of military events, the least interesting of the reign of Theodoric, and shall be content to add that the Alemanni were protected, that an inroad of the Burgundians was severely chastised, and that the conquest of Arles and Marseille opened a free communication with the Visigoths, who revered him as their national protector, and as the guardian of his grandchild, the infant son of Alaric. Under this respectable character, the King of Italy restored the Praetorian prefecture of the Gauls, reformed some abuses in the civil government of Spain, and accepted the annual tribute and apparent submission of its military governor, who wisely refused to trust his person in the palace of Ravenna. The Gothic sovereignty was established from Sicily to the Danube, from Sirmium or Belgrade to the Atlantic Ocean. And the Greeks themselves have acknowledged that Theodoric reigned over the fairest portion of the Western Empire. The union of the Goths and Romans might have fixed for ages the transient happiness of Italy, and the first of nations, a new people of free subjects and enlightened soldiers, might have gradually arisen from the mutual emulation of their respective virtues. But the sublime merit of guiding or seconding such a revolution was not reserved for the reign of Theodoric. He wanted either the genius or the opportunities of a legislator, and while he indulged the Goths in the enjoyment of rude liberty, he servilely copied the institutions and even the abuses of the political system which had been framed by Constantine and his successors. From a tender regard to the expiring prejudices of Rome, the barbarian declined the name, the purple, and the diadem of the emperors, but he assumed, under the hereditary title of king, the whole substance and plenitude of imperial prerogative. His addresses to the eastern throne were respectful and ambiguous. He celebrated in pompous style the harmony of the two republics, applauded his own government as the perfect similitude of a sole and undivided empire, and claimed above the kings of the earth the same preeminence which he modestly allowed to the person or rank of Anastasius. The alliance of the East and West was annually declared by the unanimous choice of two consuls, but it should seem that the Italian candidate, who was named by Theodoric, accepted a formal confirmation from the sovereign of Constantinople. The Gothic palace of Ravenna reflected the image of the court of Theodosius, or Valentinian. The Praetorian prefect, the prefect of Rome, the quaestor, the master of the offices with the public and patrimonial treasurers, whose functions are painted in gaudy colours by the rhetoric of Cassiodorus, still continue to act as the ministers of state. And the subordinate care of justice and the revenue was delegated to 7 consulars, 3 correctors, and 5 presidents, who governed the 15 regions of Italy according to the principles and even the forms of Roman jurisprudence. The violence of the conquerors was abated or eluded by the slow artifice of judicial proceedings. The civil administration, with its honors and emoluments, was confined to the Italians, and the people still preserved their dress and language, their laws and customs, their personal freedom, and 2/3 of their landed property. It had been the object of Augustus to conceal the introduction of monarchy. It was the policy of Theodoric to disguise the reign of a barbarian. If his subjects were sometimes awakened from this pleasing vision of a Roman government, they derived more substantial comfort from the character of a Gothic prince who had penetration to discern and firmness to pursue his own and the public interest. Theodoric loved the virtues which he possessed and the talents of which he was destitute. Liberius was promoted to the office of Praetorian prefect for his unshaken fidelity to the unfortunate cause of Odoacer. The ministers of Theodoric, Cassiodorus, and Boethius have reflected on his reign the luster of their genius and learning. More prudent or more fortunate than his colleague, Cassiodorus preserved his own esteem without forfeiting the royal favor.